Hello everyone. Today I'm going to be having a look at one of the most famous conservative thinkers of the 20th century, Thomas Sowell. Let's get up his picture here. And I think it is interesting. I think we shouldn't forget some of the very good ideas Sowell had. I'm primarily going to be looking at him as a social thinker and theorist, and some of his political thought, rather than as an economist. Although, because he was an economist associated with the Chicago School and Milton Friedman, of course, I'm going to have to touch on some of his economic ideas as well. I think it's fair to say that over the course of his life, Sowell became part of, let's just call it, the Republican establishment or the apparatus of the GOP. But he's still a very rigorous thinker, and we shouldn't necessarily hold that against him. So let's have a little look at some of Sowell's most important ideas. The first one is in his classic book, The Conflict of Visions, where he contrasts the constrained vision with the unconstrained vision. And this is quite a foundational idea. I discussed it somewhat in my book, Shakespeare's Moral Compass. It's also been discussed by Steven Pinker, among others. But the constrained vision posits that human beings are limited in knowledge, virtue, and perfectibility. Social order emerges from evolved institutions, incentives, and unavoidable trade-offs, not from rational design. As against the unconstrained vision of man, or you could say the utopian vision. Sowell calls the constrained vision tragic. He calls the unconstrained vision utopian. The unconstrained vision posits that humans are highly malleable and potentially perfectible through reason, education, and enlightened institutions. Progress is a matter of sufficient will and having the right experts. So this is everything from, you know, in enlightenment rationalism through to modern day kind of social justice, Marxists, sort of. I should say in Conflict of Visions, Sowell says that Marxists are actually a hybrid. There is some tragic elements and some utopian elements, but it's not difficult to see that, broadly speaking, the so-called schools of the political right conform to the constrained vision and or the tragic vision, and most of the people who sit on the political left have the unconstrained vision. Although we should be careful to say there are thinkers who are typically associated with the right who were also unconstrained visionaries of one kind or another. And there are thinkers who sat on the political left in their life who had the tragic vision. But these two visions, according to Sowell, come prior to any thinking about economics, crime, justice, war, often without anybody realizing the depth of the divide of these two visions. And importantly, the vision comes prior to thought. And this is where we come back to one of the things I've been stressing in this series from Pareto onwards. Later on, we're going to have a look at some thinkers like Daniel Kahneman and Jonathan Haidt who have shown this empirically. But so much of what people say and think come from some instinct or some pre-verbal even disposition in a person to be closer to one of these visions than the other. And what makes one person a constrained visionary and another person an unconstrained one? Who knows? But some people seem to believe in this perfectibility of man. Other people are natural constrained visionaries, or, you know, conform to the tragic vision. Another really important point made by Thomas Sowell, this is specifically in his book, Knowledge and Decisions, but many other, he makes the point in many other books as well, is that central planning has real limits due to the fact that knowledge is dispersed and irreplaceable, that much of the knowledge required for effective economic and social coordination exists only in individual minds, embedded in specific circumstances, and it cannot be fully gathered, centralized, or articulated to distant planners. This is why markets and evolved institutions tend to outperform top-down designs, because they can aggregate and act on information that no single authority could ever possess. Now, there's two things to mention here, because I'm sure some of you will be thinking about how does AI complicate this? But I think it's also important to try and make this concrete before we get to the problem of AI. So one of the examples that Sowell gives is actually McDonald's. Now you could think, well, hold on a second, McDonald's, that's a massive multinational corporation. How is it possible that McDonald's is embodying dispersed and local knowledge? Well, I've got a video here in the archives of this channel called How Does McDonald's Work? You should check it out, where I take you through the whole process of buying a McDonald's franchise, how it is McDonald's themselves make their money, and how it is that a local McDonald's chain, as held by a franchisee, operates. The franchise model in McDonald's means that the company McDonald's doesn't actually do any of the local advertising, doesn't kind of, you know, it doesn't necessarily choose the location, although it can have a hand in that. And a lot of the kind of market conditions there on the ground is particular to wherever it happens to be. Now, this seems counterintuitive given that McDonald's looks the same wherever you go around the world. But in fact, there are many local differences in the manifestation of McDonald's. And Sowell says that this gives McDonald's an edge to other burger chains. One of the famous examples, I think, was White Castle, that tried to operate centrally. So he's not even necessarily talking about capitalism versus communism, because of course White Castle versus McDonald's is two different types of capitalistic chain going against each other. He's saying that McDonald's has the edge over the centrally managed company because if its franchise model allows local knowledge to come into play about how, you know, I mean, there are regionalities per country. So there are products here in the UK localized to the UK market that do not exist in, let's say, every European country. So that's one level of localization. But even beyond that, there is the localization of the individual town, the stock of workers that there are there, the rates that are set, and so on and so forth. Now, there is some give and take in the McDonald's model, but it's just one example of how dispersed individual knowledge, like how is the central planner going to derive all of the things that that local branch manager or the local franchisees knows about his town or his particular area that he's got real experience in now? How are you going to gather all of that? And for the question of AI, well, really, this is just the same point at one level of remove. You take all of that data that you can try to gather, okay, out there, but there'll still be lots of things that that individual guy on the ground knows that the AI won't pick up because it hasn't been written down. It hasn't been put on the internet. It's just not available, that information. And people who are into central planning have a habit of overlooking the importance of those things on the ground. Okay, and there are all sorts of examples that you'll be able to think of in your vicinity. For example, I don't know, let's say there's an area of the town that a lot of people seem to walk past, but you know, and everybody else in that area knows that the reason there is not a proper business there is because that area is quite stabby, right? That there's been a lot of, there's a creepy guy who lives around the corner. There's a gang that operates down there and all sorts of other things. Now, you may be able to try to acquire that data from local crime references, from, you know, aggregate statistics and various other things, but it won't be the same as the specific on-the-ground knowledge of what is wrong with that particular property. So a central planner might think, ooh, that's a good location for a McDonald's, whereas the local will know, hold on a second, mate, if you put a McDonald's there, the windows are going to be smashed in every single night. You're going to have crime trouble all the time. The police are going to be there every single second of the day. And these are the sorts of things that Sowell has in mind when he's talking about local knowledge. Incidentally, Knowledge and Decisions is a book based on The Knowledge Problem by F.A. Hayek, for which he won the Nobel Prize in Economics. I would say that Sowell greatly expands it, and he provides lots of examples. And he also goes beyond simply looking at price signals. He looks at organizations, bureaucracies, government functions, and the role of knowledge in making those decisions at every level of the chain. He looks at feedback loops. So even if you're aware of F.A. Hayek, I would say Knowledge and Decisions by Sowell really does make some advance over. It's not just kind of Hayek for the masses. He does actually make some advances in the specifics of how it works. Every policy involves trade-offs. Now, one of Sowell's catchphrases when he used to appear on television or when he went on Uncommon Knowledge on the Hoover Institute, he'd always say, there are no solutions, only trade-offs. Now, if you remember a few weeks back, I made a video about the nature of economic cost and how all decisions ultimately involve opportunity costs. And this really is what Sowell is stressing when he says every policy involves trade-offs. Every intervention creates both benefits and costs. Pretending otherwise does not eliminate the cost. It merely hides or shifts them onto others. Good policy requires an honest reckoning with what is given up, not just what is gained. The pursuit of utopian quote-unquote solutions, which promise results without sacrifice, reliably produces worse outcomes than policies that acknowledge the full picture. And this is often a mistake. Leftist policy is notoriously bad for this, but also I would say right-wing institutions, right-wing parties are no stranger either to foregrounding gains and somewhat covering up the costs, or, you know, not fully accounting for the costs. And this comes into many, many, many areas of life. If you think about immigration as an issue, for example, you could say, well, the gains of immigration, greater prosperity, GDP gains, blah, 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 were very much foregrounded on the ledger. But the many, many costs seen and unseen, including the breakup of social cohesion, the loss of communities, the loss of high trust in various communities, the spreading of anger and resentment from said local communities, the increases in crime that often come with an increase in immigration, all of these sorts of things were downplayed by the very people kind of pushing it as a policy. And, you know, if we take Sowell, we could say, well, the ultimate cost of that downplaying was then reckoned with later on. Okay, that it didn't go away just because you didn't mention it. It was always there, the trade-off. And then many people were like, well, was this trade-off worth it as well? Now, Thomas Sowell wrote a book called The Vision of the Anointed, which specifically looks at people who push the unconstrained vision or the utopian vision. He also explores this in a book called Intellectuals and Society. And in both of these books, he argues that intellectuals enjoy moral authority and cultural influence with bearing little direct responsibility for the consequences of their ideas. Okay, and they can actually lurch from supporting one disaster to the next, never facing any material feedback. And now this could be, you know, world famous economists like Paul Krugman. It could be, you know, people like Owen Jones, the Guardian journalist. It could be Ben Shapiro even. It doesn't really matter. But the point is, they're not fired on the basis of being wrong. Think of how many people, you know, made inaccurate predictions in the political game about Donald Trump, you know, losing to Hillary Clinton, 98% accuracy and so on and so forth. Which one of them was fired? Which one of them genuinely lost their reputation over it? Which one of them suffered genuine material feedback as a result of being as wrong as they were? Sowell argues that insulation from feedback of this nature allows policies that sound enlightened to persist long after their real-world failures become apparent to those who must live with them. And it's always been one of my favorite books, The Vision of the Anointed, because what Sowell does in that book is extremely clever. He says, let's have a look at what people argued at the time of the policy being implemented. Then let's have a look at what actually happened, the actual consequences of the policy. And then let's look to see what the people who advocated are saying now. And he says the new idea is proposed and praised for its moral vision in the first place. That's stage one. Critics are dismissed as ignorant or self-interested, or, you know, they're backwards, you know, not sufficiently progressive, yada, yada, yada. And so they're dismissed as being reactionaries. And then in stage three, the failure is attributed to insufficient implementation, never to the idea itself. But then what he shows in Vision of the Anointed, which I think is genius, is he shows how they pivot away from what the original policy was intended to do or the original argument to some other thing, right? That the original goal wasn't what was stated at the time, but some new thing. And he does this across many, many different areas. Like, for example, you know, the original goal of family planning, was, you know, and sexual education was to furnish young people with greater awareness of, you know, risk of STDs, and just to give them, a you know, some more street smarts, and to, you know, reduce teenage pregnancy rates and various other things. That those were all the things argued at the time in the early 60s. Then when they were brought in, teenage pregnancy rates skyrocketed, single parenthood skyrocketed, STD rates went through the roof. And those same advocates now, 15, 20 years on, after, rather than saying, oh, well, the policy failed, or, you know, facing up to the reckoning, shifted to saying, oh, actually, it's bad to be judgmental about those things. And we provide sexual education rather as a kind of personal liberation, as a celebration of LGBT rights, as a way of empowering single parents and things like this. So the point Sowell is making is, like, look how the rhetoric has shifted, because they're basically coming up with justifications after the fact, because the original policy, as stated, is a stunning failure. And he what's brilliant about that book is he shows it across about, you know, 12, 13, 14 different policy areas where, you know, the anointed, as he calls them, did this. Now, one of the things that Sowell is most famous for is his work on race, and specifically on the intersection of culture and race and the way that culture affects group incomes. We're going to be having a look at that in a second. But I don't know about you, I'm getting pretty hot here. It's getting pretty hot. And you know what that means, don't you? It means that the summer sale is on at the academic agency, promo code Scorcher. And when we come back, we're going to carry on with Sowell's core ideas. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code SCORCHER. 25% off all courses. SCORCHER. Get it now. SCORCHER. 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 Promo code SCORCHER. 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 Buy it now. All right, I wonder what Sol would make of my advertising acumen there. 25% off all courses, including the bundles, including the latest Ultra bundle, which has got 7 courses in one. You'll still get 25% off. Buy it now. So let's get back to Sol's idea that culture drives group outcomes. Drawing on lots of data and historical and international comparisons, in books like Race and Culture, a fairly recent one called Discrimination and Disparities. I think he was in his 90s when he wrote that book. I remember it coming out. And many others. There's one on affirmative action, I seem to recall. I mean, he's got lots of books that go over this basic material. Sowell makes the argument that systematic... he makes a systematic case, I should say, that cultural patterns, skills, values, and behaviors explain the vast majority of observed differences between groups. He looks at skills and human capital, that accumulated knowledge and practical capability vary across groups for historical, geographical, and cultural reasons. He says that the values and behaviors of different groups in different times and places, attitudes towards education, attitudes towards work, attitudes towards saving, what you might call time preference, towards civic life, shape the outcomes more durably than external policies. And he says that the trajectories of different groups reflect centuries of their individual circumstances, but they are not a fixed hierarchy imposed by any current system. Now, lots of people may have problems with this basic idea from Sowell. Like they might want to say, actually, the you know, group outcomes are driven by genetics, for example, or by some other factor. What Sowell's argument has going for it is that he is able to show the same group having different outcomes in different times and different places. He is also able to look at some really concrete things. Now, in the history of this channel, I do have a video called Black Flight, White Flight, where we look at things as seemingly inconsequential but really important, as people in an area maintaining their lawns, mowing their lawns, keeping the paint on their white picket fences up to date, keeping the maintenance up to date. We might think of taking your rubbish out on time. We might think of all of the things that people do out of basic consideration for the upkeep of the area overall. And Sowell would argue that, and many other people have argued, that it's really the failure to do these things that show on a microcosmic level what then happens on a macrocosmic level. That it is not, for example, that people from one group are just, you know, predisposed to do this and people from another group are not. Because as that book, Black Flight, White Flight, shows, the pioneer, black migrants to an area were perfectly able to maintain those standards when they first moved to the area. The problems came when subsequent migratory waves came who had no intention or interest in upkeeping those standards and norms. And that's when they fell by the wayside. That's when people started fleeing the area. That's when crime went up. That's when the local school went down. When the local school goes down, the property prices go down, and it has a kind of snowballing effect. So you can see that it's the values and the cultural norms underpinning the thing that was keeping the place up. And as soon as those were not maintained anymore, then they went down. Okay. We also see the paradoxes of racially conscious policy. That is when people have good intention to try to equalize the outcomes between different groups. This is something that Sowell spent best part of 70 years writing about on and off. He says affirmative action and similar interventions frequently harm the groups they are designed to help. There are several mechanisms. There are mismatching, so placing people in environments where they are underprepared sets them up to struggle and drop out. Good example is, let's say somebody gets into Harvard University. Harvard University has very high standards, and they're a promising black student, let's pretend, okay? If they had gone to a local so-called black college, they would have been top of the class. They would have had all sorts of confidence boosts as a result of being top of the class. They would have had an environment that was suited to their ability. Okay, now let's pretend that Harvard have an affirmative action policy to lower standards temporarily just for that student. What happens to that same student who would have been top of the class in his local college when he gets to Harvard? Now he's in the bottom 5th percentile. Now he's struggling to pass his freshman year. Now his confidence is hit. Now he's more likely to drop out. Now he's a failure story as opposed to a success story because he is now in an environment that is mismatched to his ability. And Sowell's got all sorts of data and anecdotes to back up this kind of story that we're talking about. Second is the stigma. It casts doubt on the genuine achievements of every member of a targeted group. And I can say, as someone who genuinely was a kind of top of the class sort of student, that over the course of my life, as a result of being mixed race, everybody knows I'm half Iranian, half British, I had people even accuse me that I was an affirmative action hire, that I was there because of my race, not because of my ability, and so on and so forth. When, of course, I knew that, you know, I had some of the best grades in 80 years in my undergraduate work. I was a straight distinction from Oxford, you know, at master's level, passed my PhD without corrections. Now you'd think, well, I know that. I don't have to prove that to anyone. But the fact is that because that narrative is out there, I've still had people, you know, at different times and places accuse me of that, okay, which is irritating to say the least. You know, I'm sure Thomas Sowell himself, as an extremely bright man, had people, you know, he was frequently called an Uncle Tom, that he was a diversity hire, that, you know, he was only there because he was black and so on and so forth. Okay, and that really irritated Thomas Sowell. There is also distorted incentives. It redirects attention away from the cultural and behavioral factors that actually drive disparities. Okay, so these kind of good intentions basically have negative consequences for the very people they are supposed to help. He argues consistently, judge policies by their consequences, not by their original intentions. The compassion of a policy's stated goal is no guide to its actual effects on ordinary people. His famous book, Basic Economics, is basically a whole guide on this one principle alone. Policies must be judged by their real-world results, not by how progressive, caring, or morally satisfying they appear. Every policy changes incentives, and changed incentives change behavior, often in ways the policymaker never anticipated and would prefer not to acknowledge. One of my favorite examples of this was Jeremy Corbyn's idea that all homeless people in Britain should be given a free house. Okay, whether or not he actually came up with that, I don't know. But I remember it being a point at the time back in 2017 or so. You know, what could the bad consequences be of giving every homeless person a free house? Well, one of the things is you've just created an incentive to be to be homeless because you get a free house at the end of it. Okay, and this is the sort of thing that Sowell is talking about. That's a kind of absurd and silly example, but the world of policy is full of these unintended consequences. One of the most famous examples, of course, is rent control. a mayor like Sadiq Khan might say, well, we want to make housing more affordable in London, so we're going to introduce rent controls. But introducing rent controls does not actually lessen the demand on housing. All it means is that certain people get preferential rates and you massively increase the waiting lists for them, and you increase the incentives for corruption and bribery for, you know, the node in the network that allocates that housing. These effects have been seen pretty much in every city ever that rent controls have been introduced, including in New York, where they had them for a very long time. In fact, I still think pockets of New York have rent controls. It's been seen in London. It was seen in Stockholm, in Sweden. Pretty much every place they've ever tried it, it has the same consequences. In fact, there is even an entire episode of Seinfeld about rent controls and how kind of you need to know the right person to get that preferential rate. You know, so basically you're substituting the ability to buy with money to political connections and your ability to work the political system in order to get your, you know, your mitts on that reduced price property. Sowell always demands evidence over narrative. Okay, he has an empirical standard. He says hard data, long-run historical experience, should be above abstract theories and moral narratives favored by intellectuals, activists, politicians of all kinds. And where Sowell was so frustrated time and again in his career is that he produced study after study showing the failure of such policies as rent controls, affirmative action, attempts to equalize outcomes, between groups through this policy or that policy, catastrophic failures in the education system, and yet the actual evidence does not stop the advocates for these policies persisting in them, you know, in perpetuity. In fact, as he shows in Vision and the Ointed, they often change the argument after the fact. A pretty good example of this is all of the money that was pumped into the American education system to try to equalize outcomes, let's say between black children and white children. And then after the persistent failures of those schools, of those policies, they then switched around in the 1990s and started to promote something called Ebonics. They started to say, actually, it's not a failure of the education system that these people, these kids can't read and write and they can't speak properly at the end of it. Actually, Ebonics is the indigenous culture of, African Americans, and it should be celebrated. And, you know, it's an attempt to impose white standards on black children and all this sort of thing. Over on the absurd end of it, it's, this is kind of Western imperialism. To try to teach children mathematics is to impose a white standard. We need to have voodoo science and voodoo mathematics, and it goes on and on. Everybody knows these sorts of stories. And what Sowell would say is that this is just simply the narrative shifting after the policies failed, the normalization of failure, and then presenting that failure almost as a kind of intended outcome after the fact, which is something that progressives have done for a very long time. He says abstract theory, which is logically and internally consistent, but frequently built on assumptions that do not actually hold in practice. So rather than having an abstract theory, we need to turn to historical evidence, which is messy, which is complex, yet it is grounded in what actually happened to real flesh and blood human beings over time. And that phrase, flesh and blood human beings, is something that Sowell stresses time and again. Because just as abstract theory cannot substitute for empirical reality, so too can abstract statistical constructs. Okay, abstract groups of people who are just clusters of data could not actually stand in for the real flesh and blood human beings. And Sowell has all sorts of examples of how data can, throw up statistical tricks One of the points he makes frequently is that the same individual will fall in and out of wealth categories through the course of their life. When I think back to my own life, you know, when I just left, when I was just fresh out of university, when I was a student, when I was working part time for the NHS, okay, I was probably in the bottom rung of, I was probably in like the bottom 20th percentile or something of wealth. And that was in my early 20s. And I was, you know, studying for my PhD and I didn't have a lot of money. Okay, I was in the bottom. But then after I completed my studies, after I got my first job, after I, you know, now I've got this YouTube channel, now I'm selling courses, now I'm in my 40s and my spending power and my wealth vastly outstrips what I had when I was a 21-year-old. But that is completely normal, that your wealth curve will kind of do this. And anybody who knows boomers are significantly wealthier than Generation Z, for example. But this happens in every generation, is Sol's point. And so the fact that people over, his point is that when you're comparing different groups of people, you have to take things like median age into consideration. If the median age of a group is closer to 60 than it is to 20, and the group you're comparing it to has a median age of 20, then that's not a fair comparison, because obviously the group with the 60-year-olds in it is going to be wealthier than the group with the 20-year-olds in it. Okay, so this is just one of many examples he has of real flesh and blood human beings versus aggregate data in this way. One of the areas where this is particularly contentious, of course, is in the so-called gender pay gap between men and women. And this, again, is something that has anybody with even the modicum of statistical literacy pulling their hair out when they say, oh, well, you know, despite working the same job, men are still out earning women. And people are like, well, actually, that's not happening. What's happening is this man here, or all these men over here, they worked more hours. This woman over here, she took a career break to go and have a child. Or this man over here, he not only worked long and hard hours, but he negotiated his own contract through what Jordan Peterson calls greater disagreeableness at the negotiation zone. This woman over here, despite starting in the same place, yeah, she took a career break. She went part time for a while. Yada yada yada. So the point is with the gender pay gap is that when you start equalizing or allowing for those, you know, those sorts of factors, and you say, well, okay, let's take away that sort of noise and literally just compare like for like. So what we need to compare is not the woman who took a career break with the man who's working every hour God sends, but the woman who's working every hour God sends with the man who's working every hour God sends, or this man over here who also took a career break versus this woman here who also took a career break. This sort of thing would then normalize for these quirks of the flesh and blood human beings that we're talking about. And when people have looked into it, they're like, well, actually the disparity between men and women in that sort of case is much less than this statistic that you get by averaging all men versus averaging all women. Okay. Now on this channel, I'm probably preaching to the converted to a certain extent, but you have to remember that Thomas Sowell had to argue these sorts of points for the best part of 50, 60, 70 years. Then to keep decisions close to knowledge. So he says that the best thing to do is to facilitate systems that keep the decision-making close to the local knowledge. When decisions are made from far away, people, you know, so you're far away from people and circumstances. It's some economist looking at figures on a spreadsheet, essentially. Some dude in Westminster making decisions about what happens in a little town just north of Newcastle, let's say, okay? And all they've got to go on is aggregate data from the ONS. That guy, no matter how talented a statistician he is, no matter how talented an economist he is not going to be able to make better decisions than the people who know that little town up near Newcastle. They know all sorts of things, those people, that that guy sitting in Westminster does not know. They become less informed and more likely to cause harm making these sorts of centralized decisions. And this principle underpins Sowell's consistent support for markets, for federalism, for localism, for local governments, and for voluntary institutions over expert or bureaucratic centralization. And I should say that a lot of Sowell's reason for this belief came from his own experiences working in the, I think it was the Labor Department or the Bureau for Labor Statistics for the American government early in his career, where he realized that almost nobody working with him was actually trying to do the job. They were all trying to do other things, and he was actually just trying to do the job. And then he realized, actually, it's not even your job to do the job in those sorts of departments. And not to beat a dead horse too much, but the danger of good intentions and concentrated power. So we've talked about the road to hell is path with good in, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and how, you know, just thinking that you're moral doesn't necessarily lead to the best consequences. This is making a slightly different point, which is that what happens when the persistence of these policies keeps on leading to the same people concentrating and accruing power to themselves. Sowell's entire body of work can be read as a sustained warning of the great dangers to human welfare that come from concentrations of power, right? It's rarely coming from individual kind of villains seeking to do harm or cynical actors. A lot of the people genuinely believe, like Ed Miliband, for example, is not some moustache twirling supervillain. He genuinely believes he's trying to save the planet. The, you know, social justice warriors and civil rights activists rarely thought they were trying to like actively harm the groups they were trying to help. They thought they were actually fighting for justice, for good causes, that their waving of placards made them good people, that the implementation of this policy shows that you're a good person. This is the mechanism, really, by which the unconstrained vision, where elites convinced of their own moral rectitude, seek to redesign societies from the top down. And then because they're insulated from feedback, because they're surrounded with people who think all the same things as them, because, you know, it's basically kind of mutual backslapping association, they never really get their reckoning with the results. The people who suffer from the consequences are the people who actually have to live in the places that they redesigned. And this tragic gap from articulated rationality and the complex feedback-driven flesh-and-blood human beings that they're being applied to, you know, is the grim kind of nature of modern reality in many places. And that is Thomas Sowell in a nutshell. So I do think, you know, yes, he does end up often aligning himself with whatever it was the Republican Party were arguing for at the time. But if you look past the kind of day-to-day slop of politics he got involved with and look at the fundamentals of some of his ideas, I still think Sowell has a lot to teach students of politics, students of policy, students of economics. So there it is. Thomas Sowell, still worth reading. Now, I don't have, Sowell is one of those whose library I have at home. I don't have his books here at the lodge. I have every single one of Sowell's books. Here on the channel, I have guides to all of Sowell's books. I reckon I'm one of the few people who've read almost all of them. Maybe he's published, I think he released one on education since I made that last video, which I haven't got, but I've pretty much got all the others. Still a profound influence on my thinking. Still somebody worth paying attention to. Thomas Sowell. Pick up a course at the academic agency. Promo code Scorcher gets you 25% off, and I'll catch you all next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.